Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Recently, a 45-year-old wrote, "My earliest memory of books is not of reading, but of being read to. I spent hours listening, watching the face of the person reading aloud to me." Today, I've invited local authors to read to us from their books. Later in the hour, Chico novelist Emily Gallo reads dialogue between the title characters in her book, Kate and Ruby. Dodie Johnston reads Judy's story from China. And author Carol Gray and her daughters, Gail and Lisa Stone, read from a recently published story this mother wrote for her daughters years ago when they were young, Tina the Ballerina. My first guest will tell us how you can foster reading in your local elementary school by volunteering a half hour of your time as a Reading Pal. And Michelle, what is your job at Reading Pals?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm actually one of the founders of Reading Pals, and now I actually am the outreach coordinator. So I try to get out in the community and recruit volunteers to come in and spend an hour a week reading with kids.
Well, how did you get such an idea?
Oh, goodness. I have traveled all over the world and lived abroad. And specifically, I was working with kids who'd been sold child soldiers in Uganda. And there was an instance when I realized that I'd been all over the world working for kids in other communities in Thailand and Ethiopia and Eastern Europe and Uganda. And I really didn't know much about the plight of the kids in my own backyard in Chapmantown. I was born and raised in Chico. And spent time living all over the world. And so I was very convicted and had come home actually just for a visit. I wasn't planning to stay in Chico, but a local businessman, Rory Rothschild, approached me and said, "I have this passion and this idea, and will you do this with me?" And so together we kind of started this about 6 years ago.
So when you say started this, exactly what was it that you started? We know the name is called Reading Pals.
We started actually as an organization called Volunteers in Schools, and we were trying to recruit community members to come in and get invested in what was happening in our schools. And so that's kind of where it started from, and we realized quickly all the things that actually needed to fall into place to make it a meaningful partnership with the school district. And
so the idea was the easy part.
The idea was the easy part. The implementation, was what took us a few years to finally roll into what's now called Reading Pals. We've been Reading Pals for the past 2.5 years. And what we do is about 60% of the kids at the schools that we work with at Chico Unified do not read at grade level. And that obviously has
60%.
60%. It's a huge implication. Only 34% of fourth graders nationally read at grade level. So it's a nationwide problem. We think of illiteracy as a thing that's over there on that continent, not in our own community.
And we expect teachers to solve this problem.
Yes, with 30 kids in a classroom, 25 kids in a classroom and one teacher, and it can't be done. So we recruit community members to specifically come in and work one-on-one with students. That's where we found the magic happens. And it is magic, literally. These volunteers come in and spend an hour a week with these students, and these students are quadrupling their rate of learning each month that they're enrolled with us.
Quadrupling.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yes. I had to recheck my math a few times, but now that we're 3 years in and we've done data collection for 3 years, we consistently are seeing that.
So how can you even measure such a thing?
We take what they're already using as testing in schools. And so we take their testing scores and we figure out how many months they've been working with us in the program. Of course, you cannot isolate that Reading Pals is the only thing that's making a big difference, because they have so many different other interventions, and also students are pulled for multiple different things. But by far and away, this is one of the most common ground that the students have that are gaining in their literacy learning rate is basically what we're looking at. So we take reading scores and we do a lot of math, and we figure out what they were gaining before, which is usually about two-thirds of a month per month that they're enrolled. Ideally, every student would be on par at each month, each level. And so if you're at fourth grade and it's the second month of school, you'd be reading at 4.2. Many of those students aren't reading at 4.2. Many teachers could tell you that they're not. And so what we do is we come in and try to pick those students that are like 6 months to 2 years behind in their grade level, and we pair them with a volunteer. Doesn't have to have any education experience. If you can
read. Well, because
read,
that's what I was thinking. People might think, well, gosh, I'm not qualified. I'm not a teacher. What can I do? Well, what can a person do that's a volunteer?
Our pitch to you is that if you can read, you can teach a child to read, because really what they need is to learn to be good learners. They need to learn to be good readers. What makes you a good reader? The things that we take for granted as readers, as people who are educated and really enjoy absorbing the word, we take those skills for granted, like for instance, inferring. Those are things that the kids take for granted, the predicting what's going to happen, understanding the plot. Of a story that they're reading. And those are things that we take for granted. And so you get to sit one side by side. You get a big chair, they get a little chair. And together you look through the curriculum. They're very simple books. You get to look through the words. You can bring in a dictionary and look at vocab. And specifically, you wind up teaching them how to be good readers. And we have a whole curriculum. It's scripted. You just follow along. And you actually, the best part is you get to be the one who helps them. You show them that you're learning as you go, and then they're learning how you're learning, and it becomes this really cool partnership.
My guest is Michelle Curran, and I've invited her here. She's the outreach coordinator for Reading Pals here in Chico, and I've invited her here because if you're listening to this show, you probably enjoy reading yourself, and I would think that that enthusiasm for reading would be contagious.
Perfect.
Well, how do people contact you?
So the best way to do it is actually look up our website. It's readingpalschico.org, and you'll see on there a volunteer button. And if you just click that button, it'll take you to a form that you fill out. Even if you aren't quite ready to volunteer with us right now, but you want to get on our mailing list or our information, you can go ahead and fill it out. We have an easy application online that gets us in contact with you. And also it'll connect you to our volunteer coordinator who will be in touch. And then we do district screening, so a live scan and a TB test. Of course, we require come and talk to us if that is an issue. And then we also do an orientation, and then you kind of get right in the classroom and get to build a relationship. And you become a hero to these kids. It's one of my favorite stories, talking about the love for reading. We at the very end of the year, we always do a wrap-up celebration, and we always, we had a big, huge table with the desserts on it, and then we had another table with books on it. And at the beginning, I always ask the students, what did you think of reading beforehand? And all the time we hear, I was intimidated, I was scared, I thought I was dumb, I didn't think I could read, I didn't like reading, I wouldn't raise my hand in class. And at the end of the year, we always ask, so what do you think of reading now? And the kids say, we love it, it's better than doing video games, it's my favorite thing, I love this book. And so we wound up, finishing our celebration, and I dismissed the kids, and we expect that they would all run to the cookie table, but they passed the cookie table and went right on down to the book table. And we thought, all the volunteers, we all looked at each other, very surprised, and I still get goosebumps, because that's what these volunteers have done. They've imparted a love for reading, and of course, you love reading.
I do.
And your listeners love reading.
Since I was a child.
So what you get to do is change a child's life by helping them not be intimidated by reading, but learning to love it. And of course, we know what that does. It opens lots of doors.
Well, can you give us examples of how a volunteer and his or her student interacted?
Yes. So one of my favorite stories is of a student who was pretty down on himself. He didn't ever want to read. He never raised his hand in class. He always had slumped over shoulders. And we paired him up with one of our volunteers. And together, they wound up reading through Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And our volunteer was in his 80s, and our student was at 10. And they became fast friends. And this student went from a second grade reading level to a fifth grade reading level in the matter of about 4 months. And it was really just because someone sat down beside him and said, we're going to do this together. You are not dumb. We're going to learn. This is how I learn. And we're going to figure it out together. And they still, he'll run into the volunteer around town and say, I'm doing it. He's in high school now. And it's been so amazing. He even had enough self-confidence to run for student council and
oh my goodness.
Is doing amazing things. And it really, really was because of this relationship that they built, all centered around reading and just the fact that someone else believed in him. He was a champion and a cheerleader. And so that's what we need. We last year served about 175 kids, and this year, and we had 150 volunteers. And really, we just need more volunteers to be able to serve more kids. There are plenty of kids who need you as a volunteer, and we would love to have you come and join our ranks and be a champion for these kids to learn about reading.
My guest is Michelle Curran, and she is the outreach coordinator for Reading Pals, which is a community reading initiative in Chico. And she is inviting you to volunteer. She's given us an example of the success. And one thing you mentioned as you were telling us this story was that this person was 80 years old.
Yes.
And I happen to work with people who are older, and often the subject, their thoughts are about, well, I've got this hip and my knee hurts and I need to have a replacement or my shoulder. And so they, I think, begin to think of their limitations. Mm-hmm. And I think this would be a wonderful way to say, but look, it's a skill that you have that you don't even probably value.
Right. And we need it. We value it. So if that's you, come and talk to us.
Why don't you give us the website again for people to contact you?
Sure. It's readingpalschico.org. You can also just Google Reading Pals Chico and it'll come up.
Well, now, you don't operate during the summer, correct?
Correct. We kind of take a break during the summer and try to send the kids to the programs that the library offers, which are fantastic. We also need that time to regroup. So we have rolling orientations. We are doing rolling enrollment. So throughout the school year, volunteers can come in and we ask for a 1 hour a week commitment, and it does change the life of a child.
So if somebody comes in at the beginning of the school year, they can get in on an orientation that you've already set up, but that doesn't mean they can't enroll and get an orientation after the school starts.
Correct. We do a group orientation at the beginning of the year, which we are working on right now, and then rolling enrollment will be, we do orientations all throughout the school year. So anytime.
Well, I'm so glad you have told us about this opportunity that I think people will want to take advantage of. It's something that would be very satisfying, I would think, to help out a child.
I think the volunteers wind up getting out more than the kids even. It's pretty fun.
I don't doubt that. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you for having us.
My guest has been Michelle Curran, and she is the outreach coordinator for Reading Pals here in Chico. Last week, Chico writer Emily Gallo introduced us to the title characters in her latest novel, Kate and Ruby. Emily is also a screenwriter, and I've invited her back to read some of the dialogue from her new book. So, Emily Gallo, welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
Now, for people who didn't know or didn't hear last week, just briefly, who are these two women, Kate and Ruby?
Well, Kate is a woman in her, well, about 60, who is retired from teaching, and she was married at one time in her 20s to a black man, and his mother is Ruby, and they had a bit of a falling out, and neither of them. Ruby was estranged from her son, and Kate hasn't seen the son for 30, 40 years, and her son dies, and Kate and Ruby are forced into being together.
So we left off with Kate going to the hospital because Ruby has had a heart attack, and there's nobody else. Ruby's from Mississippi. There's nobody else in San Francisco that can come to her assistance. So Kate goes to the hospital and says, oh, no, you mean I've got to take care of this woman that we don't even get along? And so she comes into the hospital and they offer her a chair when she goes in to see Ruby. And she says, that's okay, I won't need it because I ain't staying long. So the nurse does what? Pick up there.
The nurse says, suit yourself. The nurse left abruptly. They needed a next of kin, and apparently I was the best they could come up with. Kate tried hard not to sound sarcastic. Ruby didn't answer, so Kate continued. Is there a relative I can call?
No.
How about a good friend?
No.
Kate sighed loudly. She didn't attempt to hide her annoyance. The doctor said you need to stay so they can run some tests on your heart. Have you had heart problems? Ruby ignored the question.
I want to go home.
You can't. The doctor doesn't want to release you yet.
I don't care what he wants.
Ruby started to get out of bed, pulling on wires and tubes. Ruby! Kate reached over to one of the machines that had started to move. An alarm went off, and a nurse rushed in and turned off the alarm. You have to stay in bed, Ruby, the nurse said as she gently pushed her back.
Please, I want to go home.
I'll get the doctor. Kate came around to the side of the bed and watched a tear roll down Ruby's cheek. It was then that she realized how awful this must be for Ruby. She was about to say something, but was glad that the doctor came in before she did. It would be better coming from him. Ruby, you can't take out the catheters, the doctor admonished.
I'm okay now. I don't want to stay here.
You really need to stay for at least a couple of days so we can monitor you and run some tests.
I said no. Now, please take these tubes out of me.
You're not in any condition to get on a bus by yourself and ride for 3 days. Is there any other alternative to staying in the hospital? Kate asked. The doctor took a minute to answer. He turned away from Ruby and looked into Kate's eyes. If she stayed with you and you brought her in every day to be checked. Kate looked at Ruby, who turned her eyes toward the wall. She took that to mean it would be okay with her and looked back at the doctor. Do I have to bring her here, or can I find a doctor or hospital near where I live in Sonoma County? I can recommend a heart specialist up there.
How long would I have to stay?
Ruby interjected. She took the words right out of Kate's mouth. That's hard to say right now. The doctor monitoring her would have a better idea in a couple of days. Don't you have some idea? Kate asked. A week? Probably two at the very least. Ruby and Kate finally looked at each other. Neither cracked a smile, but both their facial expressions showed apprehensive resignation.
This is Emily Gallo reading from her latest novel, Kate and Ruby. And so here are these two characters, and this is often a situation that's set up. For example, Neil Simon wrote a play about an odd couple. And when I was reading Kate and Ruby, I was thinking, yeah, here's an example of an odd couple. That was just one odd couple. There are often interesting situations created by these characters that are just nothing in common. So let's skip on over to chapter 15, Emily. And we have now Kate has brought Ruby out of the hospital, and she decides she's going to do a little gardening, Kate is. Now, this is a woman who grew up in New York, and she's going to do some gardening. And she got some things that she thought she needed from the nursery. So why don't you pick up there in chapter 15?
Kate was gone for about 2 hours. After unloading the car and lugging the gardening tools into the backyard, Kate changed her clothes and peeked in on Ruby. Crosby lay curled up on the bed, both of them snoring contentedly. There was a part of Kate that wanted to smile at the picture, but mostly she felt jealous that her cat would warm up so quickly to Ruby again.
Well, now I might mention that Crosby is a cat, and that's the reason that your cover features a couple of cats on
that's
the cover.
Correct.
You have this character, a cat, in your book. So the man at the nursery...
The man at the nursery had given her various implements, an assortment of flowers and plants, some bags of fertilizer and mulch. He also gave her advice that probably hadn't stuck with her, but she figured she could read the directions on the bags. And how hard could it be to dig a hole and put a plant in it? She started singing from the garden song by Peter, Paul, and Mary. It had been a long time since the song had crept into her consciousness. She dug for about half an hour. She had no idea when she was supposed to stop or how deep the hole should be. Well, she had the shovel, the rake, and the hoe. She had no idea, though, whether or not the ground was fertile. But wasn't that why she had the bag of fertilizer? She stopped digging, threw some fertilizer into the holes, and picked up one of the gallon pots that held pink roses. She stared at it, trying to figure out how to remove the plant from the pot. She pulled tentatively on the stem and leaves. Ouch! She'd forgotten about the thorns. She found a spot on the stem between the thorns and pulled again. It seemed to give slightly. She pulled a little harder, and eventually the plant came out, but most of the roots and soil were still left in the pot. She dumped the leftover soil and emptied the fertilizer into the hole and put in the plant.
Okay, let's skip over now, because she's struggling with this. She doesn't really think she knows what she's doing. She hears this sound. And she drops the shovel and ran back into the house, afraid that Ruby had fallen again. And so what happens when Kate rushed in the door?
Where are you, Ruby? Kate yelled as she ran toward the bathroom. When that room, too, was unoccupied, she ran back into the kitchen and found Ruby next to the window, leaning on her walker. Are you okay? Kate asked, slightly out of breath. Ruby stared at her, shaking her head in disbelief.
I've been watching you. You don't know what you're doing out there.
You could be a little more tactful, Kate said, laughing, although she was also a little irritated.
You need help.
How are you going to help me? You can barely move.
I'll just tell you what you need to do.
Okay, what?
Help me outside.
Kate took Ruby's arm with one hand, and together they walked slowly out to the yard. Kate grabbed a lounge chair and brought it to the area where she had been digging. She helped Ruby into the chair and stood with her hands on her hips, waiting for instructions. So what am I doing wrong?
You kill that rose plant before you even put it in the ground.
What do you mean?
The way you got it out. You don't just pull a plant out of a pot. Didn't you notice the dirt left in the roots?
Well, yeah, but how do you get it out then?
Give me that cane the hospital sent me home with.
Kate went inside and came back with a cane. You're going to dig it out with your cane?
Get another plant. Maybe that purple zinnia.
Kate looked over at the lineup of pots. There were two different plants with purple flowers. Which one is a zinnia?
Don't you know anything, girl? You ain't got the good sense God gave a rock.
Kate sighed and went to the two pots. She pulled out the plant label stakes and found the one that said zinnia. She picked up the pot and placed it on the ground next to Ruby. Here. Now what?
Lay the pot on its side.
Kate did that and looked back at Ruby. Okay.
Now hand me my cane.
Huh?
Just do what I tell you.
Kate handed Ruby her cane, and Ruby stood up and leaned heavily on her walker. She then lifted her foot and stepped gently down on the side of the pot. She used her cane to roll the pot and then stepped on it again. After that, she tapped the bottom of the pot with her cane. Why are you doing that? Kate asked.
Loosens the dirt. Now pull the plant out of the pot gently.
Kate started to turn the pot right side up.
No, while it's on its side.
Kate sighed and did what she was told. The zinnia came out easily, its roots intact, and still in a mound of soil. Ah, I see now.
But you can't plant it here because there isn't enough sun. Go to that hole you dug over there.
Ruby points to the end of the row of holes Kate had dug. Kate took the plant and went to the hole.
What did you do to get the soil ready?
I thought you'd just dig a hole and put the plant in.
Don't you know anything?
Kate's eyes blazed and she glared at Ruby. I grew up in New York City. We didn't have a garden or a yard. Ruby tried to get out of the chair, and Kate dropped the plant and rushed back to Ruby. What are you doing? You can't get out of the chair by yourself.
I'm not an invalid.
Ruby struggled and managed to get out of the chair, but Kate took her arm and helped her walk to the hole.
Give me a handful of that soil.
Kate took a clump of soil and put it in Ruby's outstretched hand. Ruby squeezed it into a ball. What are you doing? Kate asked.
It's not friable. Too much clay. You need to add compost to break it up. Did you buy some?
Kate went to her pile of nursery purchases and brought back a bag of mulch. I thought I was supposed to put this on top after I planted.
Yes, that's what mulch is for. But why didn't they sell you compost?
I don't know. I didn't ask for it.
Oh, dear Lord. I guess you can use mulch as compost, but you'll have to really mix it into the soil.
Kate started to pour the mulch into the dirt.
Not like that. Let me do it.
Why can't I do it?
Because you're doing it all wrong. Give me that chair.
What chair? The lounge chair?
No, that wheelchair they gave you at the hospital.
Kate went inside and came back with a folded wheelchair.
Now set it down right here.
Kate opened it and placed it next to the hole. Ruby sunk into the chair slowly. She shook her head and mumbled.
You're as useful as a back pocket on a shirt.
What did you say?
Nothing. Now open that bag of mulch and get me your garden tools. Set them all down here next to me and go about your business. I'll call you if I need you.
No, I want to stay here and help. Kate brought the tools over and Ruby barked orders at Kate while Kate worked her tail off, digging and planting. After a couple of hours, Kate helped Ruby inside.
I need a nap.
Ruby grabbed her walker and started down the hall. Thanks, Kate called after her. Ruby just waved her hand as if to say, you're welcome, but didn't utter the words. Kate shook her head and smiled. She was starting to understand Ruby.
This is Emily Gallo reading from her latest novel, Kate and Ruby. And we see these two trying to get along. And Ruby's a little impatient with this New Yorker who doesn't know how to plant flowers. So the next chapter, 16, starts out with Kate on the couch watching television, petting their cat, Crosby, curled up in her lap. And Ruby came into the living room. She's using a walker because Ruby has had a heart attack. And she has over her arm her knitting bag. And she puts the bag on the floor and sits down on the sofa next to Kate. And Kate says,
do you want some dinner? I can warm it up.
Maybe just a boiled egg.
I made salad and pasta.
Just an egg, please.
Kate shrugged and went to the kitchen to make the egg. Crosby scrambled onto Ruby's lap. Kate returned with the egg and a piece of toast. I know you didn't ask for toast, but I thought you might like some. Kate expected Ruby to make a snide comment or one of her southern sayings, but instead, she just said,
"Thanks."
They watched television in silence as Ruby ate. When she was done, Kate took the plate into the kitchen and Ruby took out her knitting. Crosby was working on unraveling the ball of yarn when Kate returned. "You might want to keep that ball of yarn in the bag," Kate said as she sat back down.
"It's okay."
They sat quietly for several minutes. Finally, Kate said, "Maybe you could teach me to knit."
"I suppose so."
Kate scooted right next to her as Ruby reached in her bag for another pair of knitting needles.
"What color yarn?"
"Anything's fine, whatever you have most of."
"Just tell me what color."
Kate sighed. She could never do or say the right thing, even when she tried being accommodating and flexible. "Okay, I'll take green."
"I don't have green."
Kate's lips rose into a half smile and she shook her head. "Okay, blue." Ruby reached into her bag and took out a ball of green yarn and started to wrap the yarn around the needles. "But that's green." Ruby looked at it closely.
"So it is."
Kate decided not to answer. Maybe Ruby's colorblind, or maybe she doesn't see well, or just didn't remember that she had green yarn. After all, she is in her 80s.
"Now watch how I do this. This is a knit, and this is a purl stitch."
Kate watched intently, and after a few minutes, she took the needles herself. She got her fingers stuck in the loops at first, but after a while, she got the hang of it. "This is fun," Kate said enthusiastically.
"No one ever taught you how to knit or garden as a child? That's a real shame."
Kate shrugged. "I lived with my father in a four-room apartment in New York City."
"No granny? No auntie?"
Kate bit her lip to keep from blurting out something she'd regret. "No." Ruby shook her head.
"That must have been a sorry childhood you had."
Kate took a deep breath and put the needles down. "I had a wonderful childhood and a loving father who taught me many other things." She wanted to add that he had never abandoned her because he disapproved of the person she married or who she had become. But she decided not to open up that can of worms. "Damn it, Ruby!" Kate was just warming up to her and feeling sorry for her predicament. Ruby must have sensed Kate's anger and maybe even realized that she ought to be on better behavior since she was pretty dependent on Kate.
"Yes, I'm sure he did."
Kate picked up the needles again and they continued knitting together. Kate asked for help when she needed it. Crosby finally gave up playing with the yarn and fell asleep on the couch between them. After a half hour or so, Kate put the needles aside. "I have some Googling to do on my computer. Do you mind if I go in your room for a few minutes?"
"It's your house. You can go wherever you want to."
"Well, I mean, were you planning on going to bed soon?"
"Good Lord, girl, didn't I just sleep all afternoon?"
"I guess you did." Kate got up and started to walk away.
"What you mean, Googling?"
Kate smiled. "Google is a search engine. You can go to that site and find out just about anything you want to know."
"Never used a computer."
"Do you want to watch me?"
"Okay."
Ruby put her own needles down and got up with difficulty. Kate held the walker steady, but Ruby pushed it away.
"That thing is too bulky. Would you get me my cane?"
Kate put the walker back and got the cane, and Ruby hobbled after her. "You can sit here at the desk, and I'll go get another chair." Kate helped Ruby into the office chair and turned on the computer. "It takes a minute to boot up," she said as she left the room. Ruby stared at the screen intently as the icons came up. She gingerly touched the mouse and moved it around, smiling as she watched the cursor move around the desktop. She inadvertently clicked on a folder and startled herself when it opened. She was laughing out loud when Kate entered with the chair. "What's funny?" Kate asked.
"I don't know what I did, but all of a sudden this was on the screen."
Kate smiled as she set the chair down next to Ruby and sat in it. "You opened a folder, that's all. Do you want to set up an email account?"
"Huh?"
"Or would you rather learn how to use Google first?"
"Google."
"Does Google make you giggle?" Kate joined Ruby, and pretty soon the giggling turned into full-blown laughter. They spent the next hour or so on the computer. Ruby was an eager student and also a fast learner.
This is Emily Gallo reading from her latest novel, Kate and Ruby. Her previous novels are Venice Beach and The Columbarium. And I want to thank you, Emily, for coming in and also for inviting me to be the voice of Ruby today.
You did a great job. You were a great Ruby.
That was fun. Again, Emily Gallo's novel is Kate and Ruby. After a break, I'll be talking to an author who wrote a rhyming bedtime story for her two young daughters in 1967, Tina the Ballerina. And later in the hour, the story of a Chinese college student read by Dodie Johnston. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. In 1967, Carol J. Gray told a bedtime story to her two young daughters, Gail and Lisa. A stuffed elephant and a baby doll were the characters in the original story of Tina the Ballerina. Joining Carol and me in the studio today are her now-grown daughters, Gail Stone and Lisa Stone. They published this story with full-page illustrations by Steve Fershad. Carol Gray, Gail Stone, and Lisa Stone, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Well, this book has a rather unusual history, and I want to ask you, Carol, how you went about producing, because it's more than just a story that you sat down and told your daughters. What did you do that was different?
I made costumes. And I took photos and had a wonderful, wonderful time playing with the toys, the elephant and Tina. It was just a joy. And I know that the girls were pleased, but I was terribly pleased.
Well, most parents, the mom or the dad, sit down next to the bed and they tell a story. But you produced, it was like theater. I've seen the original book that you created, that you made in 1967. And what you did was photograph these little toys, the little elephant and the baby doll. You dress them in costumes. And there are photographs in the book of this set. Now, I'm going to ask Gail if she's going to tell us from her point of view as the child what you remember about this book.
I remember it being a wonderful story and very well written and just fun. I recall us, my sister Lisa and I, having clothes that matched the characters in the story, and that was really special that we got to wear our Tina dress or our Betsy Ann dress.
Oh, now wait a second, because I saw the original book and I saw the costumes that your mother made, very professionally done costumes. I mean, they weren't just slapped together. They looked like you bought them in a store. And then she made you those same. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, we have pictures of Lisa and me with the same dresses in that are illustrated. Steve Fershad did a fantastic job of capturing that. He had the actual clothes that she used in the photographs to capture on his illustrations.
Because probably the original idea was to use these photographs that your mother took in 1967, and then you decided to have an illustrator. And those of us here in locally know Steve Fershad and the wonderful work that he does. Mm-hmm. But at what point did you say, oh, maybe we'll get an illustrator instead of photographs?
Well, I'm part of the North State Writers, and Tom Watson was the president at the time, and I met with him, and I showed him the original book, and he indicated that I either needed three more photographs or that I should consider getting the book fully illustrated. And since 35 millimeter film is tough to come by, and particularly matching it to film from 1967, he recommended Steve Frischaud as the illustrator, and we met many times and talked about the concept, and you see the end result.
Yeah, full-page color, beautiful illustrations by Steve Frischaud. Now, Lisa, Gail just mentioned that she's a member of North State Writers. Are you also a writer?
I am not a writer.
That's not true. I've seen your stories.
But you are... you're one of the recipients of this art project that your mother did. What do you remember about it when you were little?
I just remember that it was so fun to have a story that was written by our mom for us. And it was so nicely done. And then Betsy Ann was one of our dear friends that we played with. So she was the daughter of my mom's best friend. And it was so wonderful to have a book that was written for us with people that we knew. And, of course, who can't love an elephant?
Well, now, I don't think we've mentioned that Betsy Ann is the name of the other character in the book.
Right.
Besides Tina the elephant, there is this character named Betsy Ann, and you knew the original Betsy Ann.
We did, yes. We still do.
So at what point did you decide, you know, I think we should publish this book?
Okay. I found the pink book in Mom's Things and read through it one day. And I, as an adult, I thought, God, this is really a great story, and we should share it with other people. Initially, it was going to be an ebook only. I was just going to do a quick download so people could see it. But then it took on a life of its own, and I'm really pleased with how the whole process turned out. I asked Lisa, what do you think? Do you think that we should get it published? And she said, sure. It's a great story, and I floated it around with Dan Barnett and other people to ask their opinion, and they said this is a great story. So with the encouragement of friends and family, we proceeded on to get it published.
Well, let's hear what the story of Tina the Ballerina sounds like. So, Carol, I'm going to ask you if you will read the first page in your book.
All right. Let me tell you the tale of Tina, who became a great ballerina. Not an easy or commonplace thing to do if she'd been a people like me or like you.
And then I'm going to ask Gail and Lisa if they will alternate, and we'll continue reading Tina the Ballerina.
But astounding for Tina, born shy and wild, Tina, you see, was an elephant child. She grew up in a forest, green and lush, wearing her natural pale gray plush.
Daintily dining on grass in big bunches, with an occasional sapling for lunches. She sometimes got hiccups if one was too pricky, but bathed in the river on days she felt sticky.
Now, Gail, before you continue reading, I wish you would describe the illustrations that Steve has done for these two pages you just read.
Okay, the first one is an elephant out in the wild with lots of jungle greenery. She is... with her natural pale gray plush. The second one is a picture of Tina in a pond reaching with her trunk to grab some grass. He did a fantastic job with the coloring. You can see the body underneath the water, and she's just happy to be eating grasses.
Now, when you mentioned wearing her pale gray plush. Mm-hmm. The original Tina is a stuffed animal, a plush toy.
Yeah.
And Steve Frischaud has such a talent for making these characters lovable. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the face of this elephant, the eyes and the expression on the face are just so appealing.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Nancy. One of the things in our first meeting is I told Steve, I want everyone to fall in love with Tina. He did that.
Yeah, from this very first page, you see this adorable elephant, and you just say, oh,
yeah,
I want to know about her story.
Steve does a masterful job with eyes.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He does.
Well, let's continue the story, Gail.
Okay. But she bathed and she ate and she slept all alone. Not one single friend could she call her own. Nothing she did was exciting or fun. So one day she thought, something must be done. Surely life should not be so empty and boring. Perhaps it will change if I go exploring. So next morning, quite early, she started her trip, carrying only her trunk since she hadn't a grip.
She was ambling along, enjoying the scenery, when suddenly, shockingly, there in the greenery, was a little girl playing who said, "How do you do? My name's Betsy Ann. Would you like to play too?"
All at once, without a doubt, here was one thing she did need. "Someone to play with," she replied. "Yes, indeed. How delighted I am," I decided to roam. And then, hand in trunk, Betsy Ann took her home.
When Betsy's mother met Tina, she hugged her and smiled. She said, "Just what we needed, an elephant child. But you'll need some clothing if you're able to be a respectable member of our family."
"I'm afraid Betsy Ann's would not fit you somehow. I'll make a nightgown for bedtime and play clothes for now." She measured and snipped, and in no time was done. Soon both friends were dressed and ready for fun.
And let me pause just a second, because up until this point, Tina is just wearing her pink elephant skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then on this page, there is Tina in a bright colored dress. Now, is this drawn? Did Steve draw this from an actual dress that was this color?
Yeah, actually, it's pants and top. It's sort of mirrors what Betsy Ann is wearing, but considerably larger and
because
different
Tina's
colors.
An elephant. Right?
Yes, because Tina's an elephant.
For Tina, such fun was a true revelation, and the seesaw filled her with great elation. But jumping rope was not such a treat. Said Tina, "I seem to have too many feet."
Betsy said, "Try it. It's really quite fun. And don't be discouraged. You've only begun. If you try, there's nothing you cannot do, especially if someone has faith in you."
After dinner that night, as they dressed for bed, Betsy kissed her mother, and then she said, "It's school tomorrow, and Mother dear, could you make a dress for Tina to wear?" "I think it would be terribly cruel if she had to stay home while I went to school." So they slept while she sewed a blue dress with a frill and a pinafore, too, in case of a spill.
And so this is actually what your mother, Gail and Lisa's mother, Carol, would do. And you sewed these clothes for the doll and the stuffed elephant, and you sewed their clothes, too.
Yes.
Mom went to dress design school.
Oh.
So this isn't just a pastime. This is actually something she can do professionally.
Oh, so I didn't realize that. So this was an interest you've had for a very long time. And you just didn't decide, "Oh, I'll make a dress for my
daughter."
Oh. Well, you were lucky to have two daughters to sew for.
Yes, definitely.
So were we. We were lucky, yes.
So did she sew clothes professionally, or she just went to school to learn because she was interested in it?
Oh.
Carol?
I was ready to be a professional, but then I got married and I decided that I wasn't able to do that. And so it was just something that I always did, but not
professionally.
She did start a project at home, which was sewing and designing plush toys. So she had her own cottage industry and was then marketing these toys.
Well, that's a good thing for a mother to do. You can stay home and do this.
Yes.
Because so many women were just in your same situation, that when they got married and had children, whatever professional aspirations they had to go by the wayside.
No, this worked out very well for me. I was very happy.
That's beautiful. Well, let's continue the story, Gail.
Next day, the children all clapped with glee, for an elephant turned out so beautifully. They all concentrated to do their work well, while privately awaiting the sound of the bell. What fun! They all hoped recess would never end, to have a real elephant child for a friend. For their swings, she was just a wee bit too wide, but they patiently taught her to skip and to slide.
And the next afternoon, when school was all done, with everyone helping, which made it more fun, They held a surprise party to show her how very happy they were to know her. Some children brought cake and some others balloons, and one thought of hats and some brought spoons. And presents to open, the nicest, I guess, was Betsy's, a pink and white party dress.
And this is an opportunity for Steve Rashad to really select bright colors. So this is a beautiful page with all the bright colored balloons and the children in various colored clothes.
And let's go. And the dresses that are shown here are, my sister Lisa had the green dress that was velvet, and then I had the pink dress with pink bows.
And this green dress, it's a green velvet dress, is still hanging in the closet upstairs at Mom's house.
Mm-hmm. That fit you when you were a little girl.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh. Well, let's continue the story.
Well, Tina was speechless, her mind reminiscing on her life in the forest and what she'd been missing. So she stood up to thank them, her voice not quite firm, and said, "I'm the world's happiest pachyderm."
And so it went. Each day seemed to bring another and better, exciting new thing. But what she liked most, this elephant lass, was going with Betsy to dancing class.
First it all seemed so hard, she thought she might cry. But thinking of Betsy, she said, "I must try." So she practiced the steps and pointed her toe and finally earned a part in the show.
Now, did you two take ballet classes, or is this just your mother's invention?
We did. Yeah, it wasn't our finest hour.
No, you're not gifted like Tina.
No.
Well, Tina is an elephant after all. I mean, most ballerinas are more like Betsy Ann.
Yes. Yeah, we weren't like either. Yeah, oops.
But now Steve does have Tina in this beautiful tutu.
Yes.
And actually, you brought with you the tutu in this color with the silver trim on it that Steve must have used when he was sketching this.
Yeah, yes, he did. He had all of the clothes that Mom made for the sets, and that's how he was able to get the level of detail in the artwork that he did.
Well, let's continue.
Before the mirror, on the eve of the dance, poor Tina surveyed her figure askance. She noted each bulge and turned slightly green. "But I'm positively elephantine."
"They'll all laugh," she wailed. "And if I should fall down, they'll think an earthquake was shaking their town. And I'm shy and I'm clumsy. I'll look like a clown." Then she thought about Betsy. "I can't let her down."
But when Tina danced, unlike what she'd feared, the audience clapped, shouted, "Bravo!" and cheered. Not one single dancer in any nation had ever received such a great ovation.
A man from the circus, drawn by the commotion, said, "I've traveled the world from ocean to ocean, and no one can compare either near or far. Come with me, my dear, and I'll make you a star."
Tina said, "Away from my friends, I'd be sunk," and a tear rolled down to the end of her trunk. Betsy said, "Tina, that's silly and sappy. Real friends are glad when their friends are happy."
"You'll be making new friends all over the nation, and you can visit with us during summer vacation." Tina said, "You're right. Why am I so fearful?" And she hugged her friend, now happily tearful.
Tina left, and a great new life unfurled as the most famous elephant in the world. She was loved, she had wealth, all that life affords. She danced before kings and dukes and lords.
But when summertime came, she said, "Goodbye, now I have to go. I'll be back by and by." She would come home to Betsy, and they were so gay, they always held Tina the Ballerina Day.
They played and they sang, and she told her adventures, how the monkey cracked walnuts and had to have dentures, that the lion was really quite frightened of people, how the giraffe once entangled himself in a steeple.
It seemed like no time when time came to leave, but Tina said, "I'll be back now, don't grieve."
And so, most happily, our story ends, a tribute to all true and loyal friends.
This has been Lisa Stone and Gail Stone reading from a book that her mother put together in 1967. Their mother is Carol J. Gray, and she, when she was telling the story, didn't just tell the story or write the story. Carol Gray illustrated it with actual photographs of these, the stuffed elephant and the young doll, the doll that she dressed in clothes. So the book that you have put together is illustrated by Steve Fershad. And you had quite an adventure even getting this published, Gail. Gail, you're the one that got this published.
Yes, she did, yes. Yes, it has taken about 2 years to bring it to full fruition. It started with, as I mentioned, with the North State Writers. And then I've learned about how to get ISBNs and barcodes and copyrights and dealing with international printers. Clearly, the illustrator, a book designer. I also needed an agent to import the books before they left the country of their origin. And then dealing with customs and picking them up from San Leandro and then bringing them home, which happened last month, actually.
Well, now, you said that Tom Watson helped you check on overseas printers.
Yes.
So that you could keep the cost of the book down, because with these beautiful illustrations, it's a hardback book. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it would have been quite expensive.
Yes.
And so you want to shop around for the best price. And then you had a local designer design the book.
Yes, Carla Resnick. She's fantastic.
And then you say you worked with a printer in China.
Yes.
And I can imagine trying to communicate with, how was the Chinese, how was their English?
Well, that was, we communicated by email, and I learned really quickly that I needed to take photographs and send to them what I wanted. For example, I wanted a dust jacket for the book, and they didn't understand what a dust jacket was. So I took a dust jacket off a book, took a picture, and sent it to them. And so we were able to get a dust jacket. Some of the other issues were they didn't understand the colors of the print, so I had to FedEx to China the print as it should be, because their color schemes are different than ours. And so I'm really pleased with the end result. But initially, I was a little nervous, I'll be honest.
You were probably wondering, what did I get myself into?
Yes, indeed.
And Carol is nodding her head, too, because, yeah. Carol, you just got to kind of sit back and watch this whole process unfold.
Oh, it was thrilling. I just couldn't believe it.
Well, this is such a nice tribute, Gail, that you have done for your mother and for the three of you.
Well, thank you. Yes. My goal was to get this published for Mom's 80th birthday, which she celebrated in March. So we're a few months off, but she's still 80. So woohoo, we did it.
So happy belated birthday, Carol. It's been a pleasure talking to the three of you about this beautiful book, Tina the Ballerina. Carol J. Gray is the original author. Gail is the publisher. And Lisa provides moral support. Right?
That's about it, yes. Yeah.
Gail Stone and Lisa Stone are Carol J. Gray's daughters. In her memoir, How Was China?, author and teacher Dodie Johnston includes vignettes from her years teaching English as a second language at a private women's college in China. I've asked her to read Judy's story.
I was baffled as to why the word countryside created such a negative reaction in the Chinese, when to me it meant historic villages, meadows and forests for hiking, and hospitable people. When I told my 2000-2001 students I was from a small rural town in the foothills of Northern California, they cringed with sympathy and condolence. The next year, I came armed with pictures of my country's tiny twin towns in all their quaint glory, photos of Victorian houses surrounded by trees in a blaze of autumn color, of carriages clip-clopping down Broad Street, of peach fields in bloom, of deer grazing on green hillsides. The disbelief reflected in their eyes and comments made it clear that they recognized these pictures as exaggerated visual propaganda, something a Chinese Chamber of Commerce might produce. This was fairyland compared to their ideas of country living. How can your river water be so clear, they challenged me. Why is the sky so blue? Who keeps the streets so clean? Where are all the people? I explained that, in fact, my rural county was growing, with people eager to move from the crowded streets of sprawling urban areas to a wooded county with fresh air and less population density. They rolled their eyes. To them, the countryside was dirty, backward, and boring. To see firsthand what repelled my students about the countryside, two friends and I rented a car and drove east towards the remote seaside villages dotting the ragged coast of Fujian province. We chose to go without benefit of a Chinese guide, who would have been dumbstruck at our choice of destination anyway. Seldom do tourists go off and explore on their own. This is always warned against as dangerous by the industry. But how dangerous could exploring be in a country where most people were small and no one but the military police carried guns? My two traveling companions spoke some Mandarin, so we figured that would be enough to break the ice with the villagers and keep us from getting hopelessly lost. Concrete and brick homes in various stages of partial construction huddled together in colorless oblongs to form the villages. The dirt streets were littered with containers and plastic bags. Clearly, the city street sweepers with their green carts and bamboo brooms did not serve this area, and there was no plan for dealing with the introduction of plastic products into the village life. Occasionally, pigs and goats poked through the trash, searching for edible treasure. We stopped here and there to walk around, leaving our bright red sedans standing alongside the tiny lanes like a rosy Amanita mushroom. Our party of three, one ebony black young man with dreadlocks from Cameroon, one curly-topped marketing specialist from Chicago, and me, a small blonde older woman, attracted clusters of curious country folk wherever we went on foot. Staring villagers crowded around us to examine our clothes and comment on our hair. With little in the way of recreation or entertainment in these villages, we became the major attraction. Attempts at conversation went unrewarded. Perhaps they only spoke the local dialects. We planned a picnic at a temple on the hillside we'd seen from a distance, but found it abandoned, vandalized, and used as a latrine. Okay, how about the beach? The sight of three foreigners eating their picnic lunch on the litter-strewn pebbles soon drew a solemn, silent audience. When we stood up and gathered our things, we discovered our clothes were dotted with small oil stains from the pearls of black sludge peppering the sand and stones. The watchers found this hilarious. How ridiculous these foreigners were to sit and eat on a beach. We departed, polka-dotted, and pointed at. The next community on our route supported itself by harvesting seaweed from offshore beds. The workers were returning from their workday in small boats and barges, rubbing cold hands and struggling out of tall rubber boots. When Izzy, the Cameroonian, tried to join in the after-work soccer game, the national prejudice against blacks demonstrated itself by more jostling and tripping than Izzy was prepared for. Lack of exposure to any race except Han Chinese and recent resentments over government involvement with chaotic African regimes being courted for their resources have combined to exacerbate a strong anti-black sentiment. When the crowd began to enjoy the teasing of Izzy more than the game, we elbowed our way towards the car and fled. Clearly, exploring this particular countryside was not the lark we'd envisioned.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, Michelle Curran from Reading Pals, a community reading initiative, Emily Gallo, author of Kate and Ruby, and author Carol Gray and her daughters, Gail and Lisa Stone. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.